All right, we were talking about regulation of eating and drinking, or drinking and eating. And of course, by now, since it was 2 days ago, everybody's forgotten the three major parts of the hypothalamus. I'm going to remind you again, the dorsal medial portion, which we're going to largely ignore for now, the ventromedial portion, but this is the third ventricle here, the fluid-filled space in the middle. These are the ones that are closer to it, the ventral being the more ventral part of the medial section. And then the lateral hypothalamus. Lateral hypothalamus. And we said, except for a few exceptions, we weren't going to concentrate on specific nuclei. We'll talk about a couple specific nuclei again today. But other than that, we're not going to try and learn all 63 different identified populations of neurons in the hypothalamus. Okay. We looked at the examples of animals that had had ventromedial hypothalamus lesions at the end of class on Tuesday. Everybody recall that? You take rats and drop them into water and they would just sink to the bottom. You put them on the table here, they would just sit there, not really move around, not really care to do anything. Put them in uncomfortable positions and they would stay there. Do all sorts of mean, rotten things to the rats, and they didn't really respond very much. And you could interpret that in lots of different ways. You know, maybe this was the nucleus that controlled swimming, or maybe it was the nucleus that inhibited sadomasochism, or a whole variety of other sorts of probably erroneous misinterpretations. Our best available evidence at this point in time is that this is actually an important part of the brain for regulating food intake. And if you make ventromedial hypothalamic lesions, you get these sorts of results. Body weight greatly increases. Rats become what we call hyperphagic. They plump up. And if you look at their food intake, you can see that they actually consume more food than control animals. Normal animals, their daily intake oscillates up and down to some degree, but it's homeostatically regulated within a specific range. Hyperphagic animals, they have a higher set point for their food intake. They're taking in more than they're expending in calories to keep themselves warm and also to carry out their daily activities. And as a consequence, they're gaining weight. The lack of the ventromedial hypothalamus causes animals to increase their food intake and as a consequence gain weight. We see essentially the opposite effect of a lateral hypothalamic lesion. Remember, ventromedial caused an increase in body mass. Lateral hypothalamic lesions, animals actually eat less. And as a consequence of taking in fewer calories, they still have to eat enough or they wouldn't be able to maintain body temperature. But if they're able to eat enough, then they weigh less. And in fact, you can do sort of the extreme experiment, starve animals before you make the lesion so that they should really, really, really feel hungry. And even so, when you make the lesion, they still fail to consume enough food to even maintain normal body weight. Still lose weight significantly. So ventromedial, they eat more and gain weight. Lateral hypothalamic lesion, they eat less and lose weight. So maybe this would be a miracle diet. Just do a lesion of the lateral hypothalamus, because obviously you don't need it for any other possible purposes. Reality is that there are a lot of different problems with interpreting the results that are based just on lesion methodology. For instance, in humans, most lesions are not things that someone actually willingly undergoes. They're typically the result of a stroke or of an accident. They very typically include much larger areas than just a single nucleus or even a single region like the lateral hypothalamus. Even if you go in and try to experimentally induce a lesion, here an experimenter has put in an electrode to do a radio frequency lesion and essentially burn out a region of the brain. And if you look at the result of those lesion experiments, you see sort of the crude nature of many of those techniques. Very ragged borders around the region of interest, disruption of regions far outside the targeted area in many cases. In fact, one of the major problems with most lesion techniques is that you not only damage the area you're interested in, but in the nervous system, no erasers now, in the nervous system, neurons are often not located right next to each other, so they send their axons out to communicate with other neurons. Say we wanted to make a lesion of this region of the brain. Let's say this is the lateral hypothalamus. Okay, we wanted to target the neurons that live there, wipe them out so that we could infer what their function was. When we make a lesion in that region, we not only damage the neurons that live in that region and whatever receives information from them, but anything passing through that region. And to get from point A to point B, you can almost guarantee that some axons are going to be passing through there that have nothing to do with that local function. We call those axons en passant. Obviously, a French neuroscientist got credit for that one. Axons passing through, axons in passage. And so you could do damage in a region and infer an effect that actually has nothing to do with that specific region's function. I'll show you the example of why we got some of the effects with ventromedial hypothalamic lesions that the literature shows repeatedly that actually have nothing to do with the function of ventromedial hypothalamus. These days we have more specific or more precise methods for lesioning different areas. This is a region I work with a lot, the hippocampus, that contains a large population in this region of pyramidal neurons. In fact, we can divide them up into CA1 and CA3 pyramidal neurons. If you magnify it here, you can see very highly packed density of neurons in this region. Lots and lots of cell bodies here. We can go in with a specific neurotoxin and wipe out selectively the pyramidal neurons in that region. And afterwards, most of the staining is gone here. If you look at that cell body layer, the only neurons that are left are neurons that stain positively for GABA. Just the interneurons are remaining. Pyramidal neurons have died. So there are more precise, more targeted lesion techniques available than there had been in the past. And in fact, we can then typically avoid using these more precise techniques, problems like damage to things passing through the region. Although again, you need to do very careful controls to show that you actually did avoid that damage. So we can target it to specific populations of neurons these days, or even neurons that only express a certain protein, or only have a certain enzyme system active at that point in time. One of the problems with most of the early lesion studies that showed effects like animals that would drown themselves or look like they were masochists was that through the region of the ventromedial hypothalamus passes one of the largest fiber bundles in the entire brain. That fiber bundle is called the medial forebrain bundle. We often abbreviate it MFB, the medial forebrain bundle. The medial forebrain bundle comes from a very small population of neurons down in the midbrain region, the ventral tegmental area. And those neurons release a critically important neurotransmitter. A transmitter is dopamine. What is the major signal value of dopamine? What does it tell us is going on? Anyone know? It's essentially our hedonic signal, or to put it in layman's terms, our pleasure signal. So making a very gross lesion of the ventromedial hypothalamus, you not only wipe out the neurons in the ventromedial hypothalamus, you also wipe out the source of pleasure. This happens to just be passing through that region. So now you put an animal in a body of water. It says, why should I care if I drown? Stick it on the table where it could run away. Why should I bother? Put it in an uncomfortable position. I'm not going to be any happier if I move. Why, you know, if we did that to you, why should I bother to study? You know, it's not going to get any better if I pass the class than if I fail. Hopefully all of you have functional dopamine systems. Lack of damage to the medial forebrain bundle. So we have to be careful interpreting the results of lesions unless they're very carefully done and go through a lot of controls to show that they've focused just on that particular region and not changed things outside that region except for the areas that receive inputs from that region. Some other problems with lesion studies. This is some data that was not apparent when people first did lesions of the lateral hypothalamus. You saw the graph that I showed earlier? The lateral hypothalamic lesions caused a decrease in food consumption and decrease in body weight, right? Nice, easy, clean experimental result. Sort of mirrors the opposite result that was obtained with the ventromedial hypothalamic lesions. Problem was, that wasn't the real result. Turned out that the graduate students doing that study in the initial phases would make lateral hypothalamic lesions and all their animals would die within the next week. Over and over and over again. Continued doing that until someone pointed out to them, well, gee, your animals aren't eating at all. You can do something about that. You can force feed them. Put a feeding tube into their stomach and deliver food directly into the stomach. They don't have to motivate themselves to eat. If you gave them enough calories for that first week, they would then survive. And then you could decrease the amount that you were placing in the stomach, and over a period of a few weeks' time, they would then start to eat on their own. So the initial result of lateral hypothalamic lesion was that animals starved to death. It turned out that they actually went through a recovery process afterwards. In the early days, they were what we would call adipsic and aphagic. Adipsia means not wanting to drink. Aphagia means not wanting to eat. They weren't motivated to do either one when the lateral hypothalamic area was missing. You could put their favorite foods in them that were nice and moist and put it right in front of their face, literally shove their face in it, and they would not open their mouth and eat it. That would be equivalent. What's your favorite food? You.
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. So, okay, if somebody shoves sweet potatoes in your face and you were hungry, you'd probably eat it, right? Okay. Well, these animals would not do it. Anybody else have a favorite food in here?
Cheesecake.
Cheesecake, okay. That's a nice moist example too. Sweet potatoes probably are too. Okay. If you were surrounded by cheesecake and starving, you would need it if you had this lesion. So picture the intensity of that effect. Okay. As a consequence, they couldn't regulate their body weight. They weren't consuming food. They certainly wouldn't eat things that were less palatable or that were dry foods, like rat chow. And in fact, in those early stages, they didn't even want to drink water. If you kept them alive through that early stage, then they would move to a point where they were now adipsic, still didn't want to drink, but now they would be called anorexic. Everyone's probably heard of anorexia before, where you don't consume enough food to keep the body alive. And in this case, they would eat some things. They'd probably eat the cheesecake. But they wouldn't eat rat chow. Rats don't have a nice emetic reflex like humans, so they wouldn't vomit it back up after they ate the cheesecake. But in a lot of other ways, they mimic the behavior of human anorexics. You still need to supplement the fluids or they're not going to survive. Then they moved on to another phase of recovery, where now they're beginning to drink and eat more of the moist things, but not enough to maintain normal fluid balance. They're still not eating normal foods. And then finally, the final phase, which is essentially the data that's represented in that earlier graph, is when they're in their recovery phase. Now they will eat, and they're going to eat as much as they're ever going to eat in the rest of their life. But they're eating much less than normal. So again, very often the graphs don't tell you the whole story. In fact, the initial publications omitted most of that story I just told you. It only came out later. And it turned out to be important because we now know that the nervous system, after damage, often goes through a process that we call plasticity and recovery of function. It's not that they grew a new lateral hypothalamus, but that some sets of other neurons took on some of the functional role that the lateral hypothalamus perhaps had previously, so that now at least they would eat something, but no longer as much as they had eaten previously. And in the last part of the course, we'll talk a lot about plasticity. Okay. So I had several questions on Tuesday about other factors that play a role in eating, so I'll just put a little bit together here about sort of our current state of knowledge, not very well summarized in your textbooks, unfortunately. There are several different peripheral peptides that play an important role in regulating eating and drinking. One of them is this peptide called ghrelin. And it's actually released by neurons in the upper portion of the stomach and by various other secretory cells in the upper portion of the stomach. Some of it actually comes back through the nervous system, but the majority of the signal actually comes in as a circulating hormone. It's capable of crossing the blood-brain barrier. When the upper stomach is distended, picture your stomach, for instance, after you've eaten a Thanksgiving meal. That maximally inhibits the amount of ghrelin that is released. Okay. So when your stomach is maximally empty, you have the highest release of ghrelin. When it's the most distended, you have the lowest release of ghrelin. In fact, that forms the basis for some of the modern techniques that are particularly well developed in the Dallas area, where surgeons actually go in and implant what's called a lap band around the upper stomach so that it restricts the diameter of that upper portion of the stomach. It fills up faster, stretches out more rapidly, and decreases the amount of ghrelin being secreted. And properly applied, that's actually been an effective strategy. You can measure very rapidly a decrease in ghrelin release and a decrease in appetite. Of course, it has all the disadvantages of major surgery. And since the stomach is not a nice symmetrical organ, those things tend to slide around and slide off and can cause damage. So it's probably not a good long-term sort of a solution. However, the ghrelin that's released from this region is detected by neurons within the lateral hypothalamus. And it causes those neurons to increase release of a particular peptide called neuropeptide Y. Neuropeptide Y. And that NPY, or neuropeptide Y, stimulates a huge number of systems in the brain to cause you to want to eat. So when your stomach is maximally shrunken, it causes you to feel hungry and to seek food. Okay. In fact, if you inject someone with ghrelin, they then feel hungry and want to consume food. You apply neuropeptide Y within the brain. Individuals become hungry and want to consume food. So perhaps someday, someone will come up with a ghrelin antagonist. Or a ghrelin agonist to be able to modulate eating behaviors. So ghrelin is one important signal coming from the stomach, but from the upper region of the stomach. Okay, another important peripheral peptide, very little has been known about these until about the last decade or so, is a peptide called leptin. Leptin is actually secreted by adipose tissue, by fat cells in your body. Fairly complex peptide structure. Leptin again circulates throughout the body and is capable of crossing the blood-brain barrier. When it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it can act on several populations of neurons. One of those same neurons we were just talking about, those in the lateral hypothalamus. And leptin, in fact, inhibits their activity, causes them to decrease the amount of NPY that's released. What did NPY make you feel? Hungry. So decreasing the amount of NPY, less hungry. As your fat cells swell up and release more and more leptin, you feel less and less hungry, at least under normal conditions. Leptin also stimulates neurons within the ventromedial portion of the hypothalamus. And in particular, one small region that we often call the arcuate nucleus of the hypothalamus. That's the most ventral part of the ventromedial hypothalamus, the arcuate nucleus. And those neurons release another peptide. Leptin receptors, when they're stimulated, cause those neurons to release a peptide called MSH. MSH stands for melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Melanocyte-stimulating hormone. It's right there. Okay. That's what I was pointing at. It doesn't give you a clue from its name. Melanocytes are pigmented cells, so it has a different function in your skin. But in the nervous system, MSH is detected by other neurons within the ventromedial hypothalamus and causes you to feel satiety, satisfied. You feel full. Because of this peptide released by the fat cells, the adipose tissue. So it prevents you from wanting to eat, and it makes you feel full because of its effects on the ventromedial hypothalamus. So what happens if you lesion the ventromedial hypothalamus? You lose these neurons. And now suddenly you're not detecting leptin signals any longer. If you're not detecting leptin, you're not going to release MSH. There's no neurons to feel full. As a consequence, the individual eats a lot more than normal. And eventually, the stomach and the intestines can't hold any more food, possibly, then feeding stops. So with more specific lesions, you can pull these sorts of things apart. We still, again, don't have good pharmacological tools for manipulating the leptin system yet. And in fact, you'd want to target them very specifically just to certain populations of neurons, not just sort of a generic effect of leptin. All right, few things in the nervous system are really that simple. I don't expect you to hang on to the detail of this, but I thought I'd just give you some other examples. Regulation of eating behavior is a lot more complex than just lateral hypothalamus and ventromedial hypothalamus, or two different peripheral peptides. Okay, most people are probably familiar with the concept of binge eating, particularly associated with different emotional states. Okay, females are usually credited more with binge eating, but the actual evidence doesn't support that there is a gender bias there. Certainly, other systems in the brain that we haven't talked about yet play a role in interpretation of emotionality, and in fact project to the hypothalamus, and in particular to the lateral portion of the hypothalamus. Increasing activity of neurons in lateral hypothalamus, what did that do? Increase or decrease desire for food? No. Stimulating lateral hypothalamus makes you hungry. Makes you want food. It's when you don't have a lateral hypothalamus that it decreases your feeding. Okay. We talked about ghrelin stimulating lateral hypothalamus, making you want to eat, and leptin inhibiting lateral hypothalamus, making you not want to eat. There's also an important factor of blood glucose. And your glucose levels get too high, you don't want to eat, too low, and you lose the inhibition of not wanting to eat. And there are plenty of other peripheral substances that the body monitors as well, beyond just these three. And besides the neuropeptide Y we talked about earlier that the lateral hypothalamus releases, it also releases a large number of other substances. One that's been implicated very strongly just within the last couple years as an important peptide in feeding regulation is this substance that they can't even agree on the name of yet. Some groups call it hypocretin. Others call it orexin. Orexin. So from this small region of the brain, the lateral hypothalamus, this peptide circulates within the nervous system and affects norepinephrine levels, histamine levels, serotonin levels, opioids, the pain monitoring or pain blocking peptides the brain produces, dopamine levels, and acetylcholine levels. The only neurotransmitters we've left off that list are GABA and glutamate. Certainly those are also influenced. So the reality is that the entire brain is involved in regulation of eating and drinking. But these are important small convergence areas for the signals that give them a particularly salient or a particularly important role in regulation of eating and drinking. They're not the only parts of the brain involved, though. And I hope that you don't go away with the take-home message. Everything about eating and drinking is in the hypothalamus. All right. Another nucleus in the hypothalamus we've talked about before, the paraventricular nucleus. Paraventricular, the one around the ventricles. Paraventricular nucleus. long been known that we have circadian rhythms, daily rhythms, in our preference for different types of nutrients. Very easy to show in an experimental animal. If you give them a choice of something with lots of carbohydrates or lots of fats, certain times a day they will eat much more of one substance, other times a day much more of the other substance. Humans have those particular preferences as well, but humans are also influenced by things like marketing and peer pressure and socialization as well. How many of you, for instance, eat things like cheese doodles or Cheetos or something of that sort? Only one person is going to admit to it. Okay, two or three people will admit to it. Okay. What food in nature resembles that? It has a cheesy flavor. If you read the ingredients, you're probably not going to find cheese listed on the label.
Iron.
Iron. No, not, iron doesn't really resemble a Cheeto. Might have a lot of iron in it.
Yeah.
Okay, but is there anything in nature that looks like a Cheeto?
Poo.
That you might eat? Maybe certain maggots or something. It's probably not something you're going to put into your mouth.
A carrot.
A carrot. No, it doesn't really much resemble a carrot. They do both crunch, and they do sort of have that glowing orange color to them. But Cheeto much more so than a carrot ever would. Carrot doesn't leave, orange color all over your fingers and face either. So we can be influenced to eat things outside our normal homeostatic boundaries and outside our circadian rhythms very readily. It turns out that if you have damage to the paraventricular nucleus, you lose that rhythmicity and the regulation of your intake of carbohydrates and lipids. We're not certain at this point in time what regulates intake of proteins within the hypothalamic region. Whole new research area available to someone here. Paraventricular region, remember, had receptors for angiotensin II. What did angiotensin II tell us when you stimulated it in the nervous system? How did you feel? Thirsty. So many of these areas are involved in more than one function. The paraventricular nucleus responds to a huge number of different signals. One of them is neuropeptide Y. Okay, remember, neuropeptide Y made you feel hungry. In this case, it makes you want to eat carbohydrates or lipids. So maybe Cheetos contain high content of neuropeptide Y. Makes you want to eat more. I doubt that would be included on the label. Finally, as mammalian species, we maintain a warm body temperature. And we often think about the calories that we take in as a source of heat. Calorie is literally a measure of heat energy. If you burn the food, you can measure the number of calories that it contains. But in fact, there are other things that regulate the temperature of your body, specifically the temperature of your hypothalamus. If you put a probe into the hypothalamus, but you can warm or cool the tissue within the hypothalamus, you will rapidly change body temperature. In fact, the converse is true. Anyone here ever had a fever? I think pretty much everyone has. When you develop a fever, the portion of your body that warms up first is the hypothalamus, in response to some of the immune system secretions, things like interleukins, and various other substances. Warming your body up then actually upregulates other immune cells and causes them to help you try to fight off the infection. You feel sort of miserable during the process. You probably want to sleep most of the time. And we'll look at how hypothalamus regulates sleep when we come back from Chicago. Okay. Hypothalamus, you should be getting a clue by now, is a critically important area for regulation of homeostatic functions. They do have some effect on the hypothalamus, but they also act as anti-inflammatories. So they shut down a lot of peripheral responses that then trigger those changes in the hypothalamus. The textbook lists a very complex circuit for the regulation of eating and drinking. I would not suggest trying to memorize all of it, because it's really not complete enough. What I keep trying to emphasize to you is, why bother learning something that looks complex if it's really not complex enough to fully explain something? Probably the bits and pieces that we understand fully are better for you to hang on to. They'll probably be of more value to you in the future. Okay? But that's all I had for today. Enjoy your break next week.